Thanks for the long and elegant introduction.
Believe me, it's longer than Mises.
I'm going to tell you about work we've been doing over the last many years in my lab, trying to understand a little piece of the cerebral cortical circuit, layer 4 of CATV1. And this tells you the people who've done a lot of the work. The basic model of the circuitry I'm going to tell you about. So is there a point? Oh yeah, there's a big stick pointer. The basic model of the circuitry I'll tell you about was done primarily by Anton Krukowski and Todd Troyer with myself. Todd is now, was a postdoc, he's now on the faculty at the University of Maryland, a terrific guy, and Anton Krukowski, a grad student who's now doing a postdoc at NASA Ames, and both great guys. I was very lucky. This whole group, I've been just extremely thrilled. Nick Preby also contributed to that project as a rotation student, and then Nick and Andy worked on some other aspects of the model, and Thomas Lauritsen and Anton worked on some other aspects of the model, and then Andy worked on the development of the model, which I'll talk about at the end, so how the whole circuit can develop. Okay, so the motivation is to understand a little piece of the cerebral cortex. And so just to remind you that cerebral cortex is multiplied in area extremely rapidly in mammalian evolution. And at least to a theorist's point of view, and I think to a lot of biologists' point of view as well, although maybe not everyone, it appears to be there's a fairly uniform cortical circuit. I mean, there are variations on the theme from area to area, but there's a fairly uniform cortical circuit which seems to have just multiplied enormously and very quickly in mammalian evolution. And when a mammal gets good at something, like we're very, very good at vision, we're a primate, they don't develop a whole new circuit to do it. They simply devote more and more cortical areas to it. And so one has the feeling that there was a very interesting computational unit that was developed in mammalian evolution that can, it's taken over every modality. It's, you know, it's basically all of our conscious life is intimately involved with cortex, if not in the cortex. And so I want to understand a little chunk of that. And there's lots and lots of reasons to think that the basic processing unit is roughly a square millimeter of the cortex. And so that's what I'd like to understand. And if we, let me divert, or let me go here. So if we look at the cortex in more detail, what we find is that it's a six-layer structure, classically, although we ignore layer one, which is mostly just fibers of passage. And this diagram from Ed Calloway shows that the basic architecture, so there's a, if you have a square millimeter by six layers is the depth of cortex. And the basic architecture is that feed-forward input, in this case from the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus, which is the, carries the visual input, feed-forward input comes into layer four and also a little bit into layer six. Layer four, and what's shown here is Ed has sort of arranged a set of axons that he filled in an order in a way that shows the characteristic cortical circuit. So layer four projects very strongly up to layers 2-3 and also down to layer six. And by the way, 2-3 in a cat is actually called 2-4B in a monkey for historical reasons, but they're functionally equivalent. So layer four projects up to layer 2-3. Layer 2-3 cells project down to layer 5. Here you see its axons in layer 5, as well as, and these neurons all also elaborate in their own layer, within layer 4, within layer 2-3. Layer 5 cells project back to layer 2-3 and also project down to layer 6. And layer 6 cells project both up to layer 2-3 and up to layer 4. And this characteristic circuit where the feed forward, and I should add that layer 2-3 projects to layer 4 of the next cortical area. So the feed forward, if you're a primary sensory area, you get your input, your feed forward input from thalamus, then it comes into layer 4. But afterwards, if you're a higher cortical area, you get your feed forward input from layer 2-3 of the previous cortical area. So there's a very fast feed forward circuit, layer 4 to 2-3 to 4 to 2-3 of the next area to 4 to 2-3 of the next area. And then there's also this feedback where 2-3 projects down to 5 and 6, which project back up to 4 and 2-3. And then 5 provides all of the output of cortex. The only way out of cortex is from layer 5. And layer 6 provides feedback. So in primary visual cortex, 6 projects back to LGN. In the next visual area, 6 projects back to V1 and to every layer except layer 4. So you have feedback connections, patterns that avoids layer 4, whereas the feed-forward connection pattern goes into layer 4. And so we're going to, basically, by focusing on layer 4 of primary visual cortex, primary piece of sensory cortex, we're focusing on the feed-forward part of the pathway. And there's no, we're very biased by being looking at a piece of primary sensory cortex. It's specialized for getting a huge feed-forward input from the sensory periphery. And so if you look at, if you live looking at V1, you think that the cortex is, that the feed-forward pathway is the strong pathway and feedback is this little tiny modulatory thing. That's probably not fair. Probably the feedback pattern and the feed forward pattern can be equally strong. For example, motor cortex doesn't even have a layer 4. So all of the patterns, the primary motor cortex, so all of the input that it gets is in the feedback pattern. So we're ignoring the feedback pattern, but at least trying to understand then the feed forward pathway by focusing on a piece of primary sensory cortex and focusing on layer 4 as the initial stage of processing. So
the higher cortex areas project
in the layer 4, huh? Yes. Yeah. 2, 3 to 4, 2, 3 to 4. Excuse me?
Interneurons
are everywhere. Yeah.
And they go laterally.
They do different things. It depends on the interneurons. There are some that sit up in layer 2, 3 that project vertically down through the whole layers, through all the layers, and there are some that project laterally within a layer. They vary. As you go up higher and higher, it turns out the distinction between feed-forward and feedback starts to get muddled. So my understanding is if you go up into inferotemporal cortex, you find that the connections, and you have two cortical layers that connect to each other, sort of both connections look like a mix of feed-forward and feedback. So you start to lose the clean distinction when you go up pretty high. And so just to remind you of the basic anatomy that we'll be working with, the two eyes project to the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus. The thalamus, for some reason, is the royal road to cortex. All cortical input comes from thalamus, except in the olfactory system, which there's an old route in. So the lateral geniculate nucleus is the LGN, is the thalamic visual nucleus that projects to the primary visual cortex, with which we'll be concerned. And this is right. This is just showing this basic idea of 4 to 2, 3 to 4 of the next area and so forth. This very fast feed-forward circuit, and then there's this feedback as well. So the cells we'll be concerned with, the LGN cells that project to layer 4 and then with the cells that are found in layer 4. The LGN cells that project to layer 4 are so-called center surround cells. So as cartooned here, they're not really this clean and perfectly circularly symmetric, but they're basically circularly symmetric receptive fields. They're either looking for light, represented by red, against a dark background, represented by green, and that's called an on-center cell, or they're looking for the opposite. They're looking for dark against a light background. That's called an off-center cell. And they similarly are looking for transients in time as well as in space. So on-center cells respond to an onset of light. Off-center cells respond to an offset of light. But the main thing, so they're looking for contrast. They're looking for light-dark differences, but they don't care about the orientation of a contrast edge. On the other hand, when we go to layer 4 of cat V1, and this is not true in layer 4 of all species of V1, but layer 4 of cat V1, we find these so-called simple cells, which are cells that, again, have segregated light-preferring and dark-preferring subregions, but they're now aligned rather than in a circularly symmetric arrangement and alternating in a way that endows the cell with a preferred orientation. So this cell would respond very well to a vertical light-dark edge, and typically wouldn't respond at all to a horizontal light dark edge. Fred?
There's also this line of argument that there's actually a small orientation bias in some cells in the edges. So maybe that's the point. And that may seem orientation preference in the.
So
what is your take on that?
LGN cells are not perfectly circularly symmetric, and for one thing, they tend to have sort of ragged patchy surrounds rather than nice, complete annuli. But the other is that they can be somewhat elliptical rather than perfectly circular, and that endows them with a little bit of an orientation bias. However, when you look at the orientation tuning of LGN cells, what you find is that for high spatial frequencies, they show a fair amount of orientation bias or orientation tuning, but For lower spatial frequencies, they don't. Whereas cortical cells are very well tuned at lower spatial frequencies. So that sort of strongly suggests that, I mean, since stimuli for which the LDN cells look circularly symmetric give orientation selective results in cortex, that strongly suggests that that isn't involved in making the cortical cells orientation selective. Not that anyone has ever detected, but I don't know that anyone has looked that carefully. There's a claim that there's a couple of paragraphs about this in my 94 paper where I actually digested the literature on this at the time. But I vaguely remember that there's a bias in the retina. The retina also shows these slight ellipsoidal tendencies. And in the retina, there's a bias, I think, toward radial orientations. And then there's something like in the LDN that goes away, but then in the cortex that reemerges or something. I can't remember what the argument is. There's some arguments that there's some biases, but I don't know about arguments about a map.
But isn't this effect
Well, that's a different thing. Now, so that's an interesting point. So, everything I've said so far is in grown-ups, but in early in development, Clay Reed's lab just recently showed that LDN cells have tend to get these receptive fields are basically getting one excitatory retinal input, occasionally two, but typically just one excitatory retinal input. In early in development in ferrets, the LDN cells will get two or three hotspots of input. They'll get several retinal inputs. They haven't pruned down yet. And of course, if you get two makes a line. So they argued that this might help seed orientation development, even though later the orientation this orientation bias of the LDN cells prunes away. Of course, often they get three, not two, and then it wasn't a very convincing argument to me, but. Maybe. Clearly, the fact that LDN cells look different during development is something we're going to have to take account of and haven't taken account of.
Are there on-off cells in LDN?
Not in cats or monkeys. I think there might be in some other species. Okay, so. So one concept that's going to be crucial here, so let me introduce it at the outset, is the idea of the relative versus absolute spatial phase of a simple cell. So by relative phase, I mean where is your light preferring and your dark preferring regions relative to the center of the receptive field. So these two have the same relative phase. By absolute phase, I mean where is your light preferring or dark preferring subregions relative to the visual world. So these two have opposite absolute phase. This one prefers light in the same visual space where this one prefers dark. But they have the same relative phase because they both prefer light in the center of the receptor field. Similarly, these two have the same absolute phase, but they have opposite relative phase. So absolute phase is the concept I'm basically going to be concerned with again and again. So when I talk about spatial phase, I'm going to mean absolute spatial phase. Where are your subregions with respect to the world? So outline of the talk. First, just very generally, what's the structure of the LDN input to a layer 4 simple cell? What's the problem that the cortex has to solve? The LDN input will have some tuning. The cortical cell will have some different tuning, and that difference is the problem the cortex needs to solve. So let's try to understand that. Second, I'll try to show how a simple model circuit that we've developed, which we call correlation-based circuitry, can explain a number of response properties. Orientation tuning and various properties related to orientation tuning, which we published in a 98 paper, temporal frequency tuning, which was published in a paper this year, and then certain contrast-dependent nonlinearities and also so-called cross-orientation inhibition, again, recently came out. And then, if we're all still standing, or if I'm still standing and you're still sitting, we'll talk about how this model circuit can develop from simple activity-dependent plasticity rules. And finally, at the end, I'd like to come back to the idea of, okay, all of this is a lot of detail about understanding layer 4 of CAT V1, but can we abstract from this some general ideas about cortical circuits and about what layer 4 might be doing? And the themes I want to highlight that we'll come back to are the idea of having strong feed-forward inhibition, which is, in some sense, opponent. You get inhibited by an activity pattern that's opposite to or anti-correlated with the pattern that excites you, and that this feed-forward opponent inhibition gives you gives layer 4 magnitude invariant form recognition, which is a generalization of the idea of contrast invariant orientation tuning, which is what we're going to talk a lot about in layer 4 of CAD V1. Okay, so start out with what's the structure of the LGN input to a layer 4 simple cell. So Hubel Wiesel a long time ago proposed that the on and off subfields of a simple cell are derived from getting a row of on-center LGN input over the on-subregion and a row of off-center LGN input over the off-subregions. And this was confirmed recently by Reed and Alonzo. And what they did was they recorded simultaneously from LGN and from cortical cells and looked at the cross-correlations between them and found LGN cells that were connected to simple cells as judged by this strong monosynaptic peak in the cross-correlation. And so what this diagram shows is a summary diagram of all of their data, where basically the way to think about this is, this is a simple cell with an on-subregion and two off-subregions, and each of these circles represents the centers of LGN center surround cells that were connected to the cortical simple cell. Yeah, Mary?
So with that one, that image comes from reasoning the cortical cell and varying the LGN cell, or did they also vary the cortical cell?
No, they varied both. And this is a composite from lots of cortical cells and lots of LGN cells as to which LGN cells were connected to a cortical cell. Well, it statistically proves it in the sense that they can come up with statistics of, you know, if the LGN cell was correctly overlapping the cortical cell, what percentage of the time was it connected? And then you can count how many LGN cells there are that should be so overlapping in such a way, and you can, from those statistics, you can then say how many inputs an individual cortical cell typically receives. Is independent of what?
So one could make up this absurd rule that one LGN cell connects to other as an out. You could still observe this density.
Right, but if you start seeing probabilities of 60 and 70%, it'd be hard, but you had a perfect exclusion rule like that, it'd be hard to get probabilities that high, I think. Well, if right at the sweet spot, so at the very strongest, if it overlaps the strongest part of the receptor field and has the correct sign and correct temporal, it's the same temporal properties and so forth, I think the probability of a connection was very high. And I forget what the number is, but I forget if it's 60 or 80 or 90, but it's very high if you're in the sweet spot. And then it decreases if you go away from the sweet spot. The sweet spot, the strongest point in the receptive field. So, what? what this shows is that, indeed, the on-center cells that were connected to a simple cell tended to overlie an on-subregion, and the off-center cells that were connected to a simple cell tended to overlie the off-subregion, just as Hubel and Wiesel had proposed. So. We're going to take this sort of Hubel-Wiesel connectivity as a starting point and ask, what's the orientation tuning then of the LGN input that a simple cell should receive, assuming that anatomically it has this Hubel-Wiesel arrangement of inputs? And this is going to lead us into the problem of contrast invariant tuning. So for the luminance, for the stimuli we're going to study, will be drifting sinusoidal luminance gratings, drifting across the receptive field of the cell. And if I want to tell you what the LGN input looks like, I need to have a model of LGN cell response. So I'm going to use a very simple model, which is just linear up to rectification. So since there's a sinusoidal stimulus, then the LGN response is the sinusoidal rate modulation up to rectification. So at low contrast, I haven't told you what contrast is yet. Does everyone know what contrast is? Okay. So at low contrast, there's just a sinusoidal rate modulation, and there's no change in the mean firing rate of the cell. But when you go to high contrast, the modulations get big enough that you can go up much higher than you can go down before you hit zero. Background firing rates are 10 or 15 hertz. And so the mean rate of firing starts going up with contrast because of this LGN rectification, firing rate rectification. And this rectification kicks in very early, actually. It kicks in at about 5% contrast. So over most of the range of contrast, you're rectifying and your mean rate is going up with contrast.
Is that really a pretty good model of an LGN?
It's an okay model of an X cell. And we're focusing on X cells, which provide the primary input to Area 17. In reality, they don't fill this much. Their response doesn't fill this much of a stimulus cycle. It tends to be more restricted. So that's one way that the model isn't right. But otherwise, it's probably a reasonable model. What we do is we take data of the F1 of the first harmonic of the spike response versus contrast. And then we use our linear rectified model. And so for a given, so here's contrast, here's the F1, which comes from the data. And then the DC comes from assuming a linear rectified model that has that F1. And so we can get the DC, the mean rate of the LGN firing, and it starts going up about 5% contrast. So if we then think about the net LGN input to a simple cell, so what I'm showing you here are high contrast gratings or low contrast gratings, and either at the preferred orientation of the cell or at the null orientation, by which I mean the orientation orthogonal to the preferred. And so if we start with the high contrast preferred orientation stimulus, well, when the light is over the on-center cells and the dark is over the off-center cells, I'm getting lots of input. So I get a big peak of input. When this drifts a little bit further, so dark is over the on-center cells and light is over the off-center cells, all of my LGN cells are suppressed together. I get a big trough in my input. So I get a big temporal modulation of the input because all of my LGN cells are modulating their firing rates together. They're all modulating in phase. When I look at the null orientation, different cells are modulating with different phases. When some of my LGN cells are being excited, other ones are being inhibited. But the mean rate of firing the mean rate of LGN input in this condition is the same as the mean rate of LGN input in this condition. The mean rate of LGN input is just the sum of the mean rates of all the individual LGN cells. But the individual LGN cells, their mean rate doesn't depend on orientation. So the sum of their mean rates doesn't depend on orientation. So I have a mean rate of input which is the same at the null orientation as it is at the preferred orientation. And what is it then that tells the cell what orientation it's seeing? It's not the mean rate of LGN input it receives. It's the degree of modulation of that input. When it's seeing its preferred orientation, its input is strongly modulated about the mean. When it's seeing the null orientation, there's basically no modulation because all the LGN cells fire at different phases and they all wash out. Now, when we go to low contrast, it's the same story, but the mean is lower and the modulation is also lower. But again, the mean doesn't depend on orientation. The mean is the same at the null orientation or the preferred orientation. And what distinguishes one orientation from another is a degree of temporal modulation of the input. So, question? Oh, because we're measuring relative to background. So there's some background conductance. But there's spontaneous activity of these LGN cells. And they get suppressed below their spontaneous rate, so you can go below background. Mary, you're confused. Of the off cell firing when the point is the light bar. Okay.
There's a minimum gradient for this one working.
Well, it'll as the gradient gets wider, you'll get less and less response, but you'll still get an orientation tuned response. Up to some point. I mean, I suppose if it's really big, then you're just running an edge. You're just running edges by the cells, but. Basically, what happens is that the lower the spatial frequency, the broader the orientation tuning. of the modulation, but you still have some modulation, and that modulation is still orientation tuned.
It also goes away very high frequency.
As you go to high spatial frequencies, basically as you go from low spatial frequency to higher spatial frequency, the orientation tuning of the modulation narrows. But the amplitude is, the amplitude has some peak when you're matched. So the orientation tuning bandwidth, so in other words, So if I look at the orientation tuning of the modulation, then as I go from low temporal frequency to high temporal frequency, I monotonically get narrower. But this is normalized to the maximum at that temporal frequency, right? That spatial frequency. But if I look at how big is the response versus spatial frequency, you know, it'll be something like that with a maximum where here's high spatial frequency and here's low. So you're getting monotonically narrower in orientation, but you're going up in response in the amplitude of the modulation until you get to the best frequency for the cell, and then you go down again. Mm-hmm. So the rectification is what causes the mean to go up at higher contrast relative to lower contrast. Right? But this is the sum of all these LDN inputs. So even though individuals rectify, the sum ends up being pretty sinusoidal. Is it obvious? I don't think it's obvious. I can show you. We have a, basically, if you work through it, so we actually, I mean, this is a cartoon of 9 inputs, but it's really, we have a Gabor function where we sampled a lot of inputs. And if you work out the mathematics of a Gabor function filtering a sinusoidal input, you get that the result is very, very sinusoidal, even though the LDN, the individual LDN cell responses may rectify and be nonlinear. Probably a little, but it's actually the DC and the F1. I mean, in other words, if you analyze the input expected from a Gabor filtering of the stimulus, the DC and the F1 completely dominate. The higher harmonics are just tiny. So, which basically means you've got a sinusoid. I can point you guys to a paper we've written about that, but it would be a longer argument. Okay. So if we then take as our measure of the LDN input the peak of the input, which is equal to the mean plus the size of the modulation, the peak, and we look at the tuning of the peak, what we find is this, that at low contrast, so here's orientations, and at low contrast we have some tuning. This tuning is due to the modulation, and here we're reduced just to whatever the size of the mean was, and the modulation adds to the peak on top of the mean. And at high contrast, similarly, we have some nice tuning, but the high contrast is standing way above the low contrast, and so this gives the problem of contrast invariant tuning. If we put a threshold here, we'd have good tuning at low contrast, but we wouldn't be tuned at high contrast, or wouldn't be very tuned. We'd respond to all orientations. If we put a threshold up here, then we would be well tuned at high contrast, but we wouldn't respond at low contrast. And so just based on the LDN input alone, that's not enough to explain, well, so how do cortical cells really respond? They really respond in a contrast invariant manner. So this is a sort of typical cell from the Freeman lab. Here's a response of 5%, 20%, and 80% contrast. The response grows with contrast, but the bandwidth doesn't widen with contrast. And they looked across 100 or so cells, and you know, some cells get a little wider, some cells get a little narrower, but basically there's no systematic trend toward varying of the tuning width with contrast. So the cortex has got to add something to the LDN input in order to explain the contrast invariance of the orientation tuning.
I mean, if you don't plot the rings.
Well, if all you're concerned with is, well, in fact, I mean, all that they really have shown is that the half width at half height, which is what was their measure of bandwidth, doesn't change in any systematic way with contrast. There's some variability, but it's not systematic.
How do you find half height?
Well, from there to background, which is here. This dotted line, I think, represents background, or yeah. So basically, this measure is totally insensitive to what happens in the tails. So no one has systematically studied what happens in the tails with contrast. It's a complete unknown. I mean, some physiologists might think they know it from their experience, but no one has published anything about it. I've never asked. I mean, the question hasn't come up. I think if you ask Tony Motion, who has very strong opinions on these sorts of things, he would tell you that the tails don't change. But that would be my guess. So let's try to generalize this idea a little bit. What is this? So there's this untuned portion of the input, this mean input, and then there's this tuned portion, which is the modulation. And an idea I want to begin to introduce is, let's think about not just a simple cell, but let's think about a simple cell having an imaginary antiphase partner. And the antiphase partner has exactly the same receptive field, except the opposite absolute spatial phase. And then we can think about the input the cell receives, we can think about dividing it into the phase-specific part, which is the part that's different between what you receive and what your antiphase partner is receiving at the same time, and the phase non-specific part, which is the same to you and to your antiphase partner. And if you think about the input you're getting at the null orientation, this is phase non-specific. The mean, if I turn all the on-center cells to off-center cells and turn all the off-center cells to on-center cells, the mean input is going to be just the same. And there's basically no modulation. So the mean input is the phase non-specific part of the input. It's the same to you and to your antiphase partner. The modulation, on the other hand, is the phase-specific part of the input. If I'm going up, my antiphase partner is going down at the same time. So the modulation is phase-specific, and the mean is phase non-specific. And so this might already suggest in your mind, well, a clever way to get rid of the mean and leave the modulation is to have antiphase inhibition. If you get inhibition from your antiphase partner, when you're getting phase-specific input, then your antiphase partner isn't activated, and so you can fire just fine. When you get phase non-specific input, then your antiphase partner is activated at the same time, and if that's inhibiting you, then that can turn into a net inhibition. You won't respond to this phase non-specific input. So just to plant that seed, so let's look at it another way. Just some very simple linear mathematical model of the response. Suppose that the simple cell receptor field is described by a Gabor function. Everyone knows what a Gabor function is? And okay, so a Gabor function is just a sinusoid multiplied by a Gaussian. And it's a model that is typically fit to simple cell receptor fields and seems to provide actually a very good fit. So when we describe the simple cell, so basically the negative regions, so we have some Gaussian envelope and we have our sinusoid. Whoops, have to go down again. So there's our Gabor function. The positive regions are typically positive is light preferring and negative is dark preferring. And so the positive is taken to be regions where you're getting on-center input, and the negative going portions are regions where you're getting off-center input. So if we think in terms of a model, because they're dark preferring. So if we think in terms of a model of LGN response, we can break the Gabor up into its positive part, which is the region of the Gabor describing on-center input, the spatial arrangement of on-center input, and its negative part, or the inverse of its negative part. So this will be a positive quantity, G minus, which is the region of the which is non-zero only in the region receiving off-center input. And so then the total LGN input is just G plus times the activity of the on-center cells plus G minus times the activity of the off-center cells. Well, let's split up the activity of the LGN cells into sum and difference. So the difference is the phase-specific part of the input, the on-center minus the off-center input. And the sum, or average, is the phase non-specific part of the input, the on-center plus the off-center input. So then L on is just L sum plus L difference, and L off is just L sum minus L difference. So we just rewrite this down here. And then we collect terms. The L difference is multiplying G plus minus G minus, and the L sum is multiplying G plus plus G minus. Well, G plus minus G minus is exactly the original Gabor function, whereas G plus plus G minus is the absolute value of the original Gabor function. And so what we end up with is we get that the difference, or the phase-specific part of the input, is filtered by the Gabor function, but that the sum, or the average input, the phase-nonspecific part of the input, is filtered by the absolute value of the Gabor. So people typically use a linear model of LGN input, and when they do, they're just restricting to this term. They're ignoring this term. But this term, and you can ignore this term if it doesn't change, if it's just a constant background, if it doesn't change with your stimulus. But because of LGN rectification, this term changes with your stimulus, because the mean starts to go up with contrast. In a linear model of response, when you change the contrast, you don't change the mean luminance, and therefore, if you had a linear model of response, you wouldn't change the mean response. But in fact, because of this LGN rectification, the mean input goes up with contrast. That's what's described by this term. So we just very generally, from a simple linear model, the input splits up into a phase-specific part, which is the usual linear model, plus a phase-nonspecific part. And this phase-nonspecific part, then, is the part that really creates a problem and that one has to deal with, that the cortex has to deal with somehow. Okay, everybody with me? That's right. Yeah, just show that mathematically things split up in this nice, simple way.
So that's assuming, does this assume the background sign of LGN itself is zero?
No, not at all. Just take, you know, plug in that the background is 10 to 15 hertz, and then they modulate sinusoidally up to rectification. If the background rate is incredibly high, then G minus and G plus describe the Gabor.
Okay.
But if the background rate is incredibly high, so you never rectify, then this term doesn't change. On goes up when off goes down. Off goes up when on goes down. They perfectly balance, and this term is just a constant. So this becomes a stimulus-independent constant. But it's because of rectification that this isn't that this is stimulus dependent. All right. And finally, just to hammer it home, so I probably spent too much time, but what I want to make clear is that there's this general problem independent of your specific model of how to solve it. And then we can think about different ways to solve it. So I've told you about responses to a drifting grading, but of course this mathematical analysis didn't depend on it being a drifting grading or anything. It was just a very general statement about there's a linear phase-specific term and a nonlinear phase-nonspecific term. Go ahead, Fred. Oh, sorry. Well, but the same arguments apply for flash stimuli. So if I show a low-contrast flash that's right over a cell's on subregion, I'll weakly activate all these LGN cells. And that's a phase-specific activation. The antiphase partner would be getting inhibited, or would be getting its input suppressed at the same time that this guy is getting its input excited. But if I show the cross orientation, then these LGN on-center cells here, but I show it at high contrast, then these LGN on-center cells are getting their rates raised a lot. These off-center cells are getting their rates suppressed, but they can only go down to zero. And so the net result is I get a positive pulse of LGN input, because you can go up a lot more than you can go down. And this is basically a phase non-specific input, because if you looked at the antiphase partner, it would have some going up a whole lot here and some going down a little bit there, and again, it would get a positive pulse of LGN input. Both phases would get a positive pulse of LGN input to this stimulus, and whereas only your own phase and not your antiphase partner gets input to this flash. So they can both give the same pulse of LGN input, but if you keep track of what's happening to your antiphase partner, you can tell them apart. And so you can respond to your preferred stimulus even at low magnitude and not respond to your non-preferred stimulus even at high magnitude, because this one activates your antiphase partner too. And so you keep track of that and say, uh-oh, if my antiphase partner is activated, I don't want to be active at the same time.
Before the LGN starts to rectify, there is no problem of contrast anyway.
Right. The only problem is that the F1 is still growing. And if you assume a linear threshold model, then you could still have an iceberg effect. However, as Carl van Rieswijk, I think, talked about, and Todd Troyer and I independently came to the same conclusions, and we have a paper coming out on it. The neural noise sort of, as Carl describes it, melts the iceberg and gives you a power law relationship. And a power law where zero is at rest. And so if you have this power law relationship, then there's no threshold. And so then there really is no problem until you start having rectification. And actually, if you look at Friedman's data, there might be some systematic tendency for orientation tuning to get wider at the very low contrast, 1 or 2%. It's hard to tell because there's you know only a couple of data points down there. But it's not absolutely clear that you stay contrast invariant all the way down to 1%. So, one more thing. Just to belabor this point, some of you might have thought, well, okay, we have a DC of the input for, well, we know synaptic depression can suppress the DC of the input. It's concerned with changes, and it's not very much concerned with constant things. So maybe synaptic depression would solve this problem. Now, it wouldn't work for flash stimuli, and it turns out it won't work for high frequencies, but at higher temporal frequencies, it doesn't suppress the DC of the input nearly as well. But maybe it will help for low frequency drifting grading. So we model depression as saying that after every presynaptic spike, the synaptic weight is multiplied down by a constant around 0.6, and then between spikes it recovers back to full strength with a time constant around 100 milliseconds. This is the Abbott and Diane or the Sodics and Markram model. Or Abbott and Nelson, I mean, or Sodics and Markram. And so we looked at that, and I should have a better presentation, better, more condensed form of this, but I don't. So what I'm showing you is high contrast and low contrast, DC and F1, with synaptic depressions in blue, without synaptic depressions in red. You notice with synaptic depression, the F1 gets bigger. That's because we had to adjust the weights. We had to increase the weights to compensate for the synaptic depression to get back into the same operating regime. So it's not exactly the same model, but it's in the same regime. But what you see then is that with synaptic depression, the DC goes way down. This is at low temporal frequency, like I think at 2 hertz. At high temporal frequency, you don't get nearly so much of an effect. But so you do decrease the DC by a lot. But so you help solve the problem, but the problem doesn't go away. Because if you look here at low contrast, the peak input is about 1.5 nanosiemens. The mean is zero, so the peak being the DC plus the F1 and the DC being about zero. Well, here the DC is about 0.5, and so the peak, the 1.5 is achieved about here. So what you're just barely getting to at your best orientation at low contrast, you've got way more than that at, you know, plus or minus 50 degrees at high contrast. So synaptic depression helps. It makes the problem less bad, but it doesn't solve the problem. Okay. So in summary of this first part, a simple cell receives plenty of LDN input to a null-oriented stimulus at high contrast. This arises primarily due to LDN rectification. The appropriately stimulated LDN cells can really raise their firing rates, while the inappropriately stimulated ones can only decrease their firing rates to zero. This input you receive at the null orientation is basically phase nonspecific. It's roughly identical for a cell and its antiphase partner, whereas the LDN input to the preferred orientation is phase specific. It's opposite for a cell and its antiphase partner. So this is going to motivate us to think about phase-specific antiphase inhibition. So that's the general problem. What might be solutions? Well, the one we're going to explore is the one I've obviously been pointing to, is antiphase inhibition. You should receive strong inhibition from cells preferring roughly the opposite absolute spatial phase. The nice thing about the antiphase inhibition is it's selective. When you're seeing your preferred stimulus, it gets out of the way. You're not fighting any inhibition when you're seeing your preferred stimulus. But then when you see a non-preferred stimulus, the antiphase inhibition overwhelms the feed-forward. And this should all be feed-forward inhibition driven by the LDN inputs, driven through interneurons. So when you're seeing a non-preferred stimulus, then you activate your antiphase partners, and they inhibit you, and you don't respond to the stimulus. But there's other ways that one could solve the problem. One possibility is just have cross-oriented inhibition. Get inhibition from cells that prefer the opposite orientation. As I'll show you in a minute, the data is data certainly suggests that cross-orientation inhibition is weak if it's there, so we tend to exclude it. Another possibility is to have phase non-specific inhibition. Just get some sort of global inhibition, contrast-dependent inhibition, for example, which is strong enough. So if we have these curves of input versus orientation at high contrast and low contrast, then if you get some phase, so just some contrast-dependent inhibition, which at low contrast sits about here, and at high contrast sits about here, that would work too. It doesn't have to be phase-specific. The nice thing about phase-specific is it sits here, but then it gets out of the way when because it has the opposite phase when you're seeing your preferred orientation. So it gets that. But one could just have a straight line, have phase non-specific contrast-dependent inhibition, and that would work. It would just be less efficient. And there's actually now some evidence that, so there is some of this going on, because so we originally proposed this, and as I'll show you, one of the key predictions is that the inhibitory neurons have to respond even at the null orientation. They have to respond to all orientations, because the LGN input is driving you even at the null orientation. Somebody has to respond to that driving LGN input and turn everybody else off. So we predict that there should be inhibitory cells locally within the column that respond to the null orientation. But we predict they should have an orientation tuning like this. Well, Judith Hirsch has found in her intracellular recordings in layer 4, we don't know much about inhibitory cells, but in intracellular recordings, she occasionally gets an inhibitory cell, and she fills the cell, so she can tell later that it was an inhibitory cell. And she's now found there are two classes of inhibitory cells in layer 4. There are simple cells that look for all the world like other simple cells, and then there's complex cells that have mixed on-off responses throughout their receptive field that are untuned for orientation. And so those would provide both of these. I mean, it basically provides just a contrast-dependent inhibition. On the other hand, there's also a lot of evidence that you're getting anti-phase inhibition. And so apparently there's some mixture of anti-phase inhibition and these complex cells probably some mixture doing the job. But we're going to focus on this solution, which is the only one we've studied in modeling. Yeah, Fred and then Mitya. Or go ahead. Well, what I know for sure is in the anti-phase inhibition case, you just need the inhibition to dominate the excitation. And then the more inhibition you pour on, the tighter the orientation tuning gets, but it stays contrast invariant. You don't have to adjust anything. Let's go a little bit further and then come back to that. Remind me to come back to that certainly by the time I get to the slide that says summary of part one. Remind me to come back to that. In this case, my sense is you need a tighter tuning because it doesn't get out of the way to the preferred. So you can't be too strong or you'll inhibit your response to the preferred stimulus. So yeah, my sense is that these probably have to be better tuned than these to sit at just the right place.
So in terms of inputs, started by our patient preference, the first one requires inputs of orthogonal orientation.
Cells preferring the orthogonal orientation. That's really what I mean by cross-orientation inhibition. Yeah.
The second doesn't differentiate you can get inputs from all preferred orientations.
Right.
And the third requires inputs from the same preferred orientation.
Right.
As the cell.
Right. That's exactly right. So the constraints from experiment, well, before we had Judith's result about these complex inhibitory cells, they pointed very strongly to anti-phase inhibition. Yeah, Mary.
So how do you know
the but self-inhibition would be same phase inhibition, right?
By
No, because that would be, that'd be getting inhibited by the same stimulus that excites you instead of getting stimulus, getting inhibited by the opposite stimulus. Does that make sense? So you're getting inhibition from cells that look just like you, but they have the opposite spatial phase. They prefer dark where you prefer light. They prefer light where you prefer dark.
No, but not just that, also on and off. I mean, if it was just that, you could reverse the time. But there's also an on and off.
I'm not clear. So what do you mean by so in other words, if you inhibition from the antiphase would be like excitation from the same phase, is that what you're saying? I guess the difference is, well, you can have both, but excitation from the same phase, you know, in that when you're getting stimulated out here, when you and your antiphase partner are both, the point is because of rectification, the input to you and the input to your antiphase partner are not equal and opposite. The phase-specific part of the input is equal and opposite, but there's a phase non-specific part of the input which is equal and the same. And so the phase non-specific input does its job when, I'm sorry, the antiphase inhibition does its job when you're seeing phase non-specific input. That means you're both getting positive input. Then the inhibition dominates the excitation and you don't respond. So the non-intuitive part is that the antiphase, your antiphase partner isn't seeing the negative of what you're seeing. It only sees the negative in the phase-specific part, but there's this phase non-specific part and that's the part that gives us a problem. High pass filter in time. I guess. I see. Yeah. I'm trying to think if you would get into trouble. No, maybe a high pass filter would do the job. Plus a high pass filter plus the noise to get rid of the threshold. For a flash stimulus, then it wouldn't help. Yeah, that's a good point. Oh well, I think we took data from. So actually, what we did, we looked at the data for layer 4 for thalamocortical synapses, and there seemed to be two kinds of data. There's data where people looked at paired pulse depression, and there's data where people looked at trains. With paired pulse depression, the parameters for the thalamocortical came out to about 100 milliseconds. With trains, it comes out to about 300 milliseconds. And so we actually have studied both cases, but one I showed you was for the paired pulse parameters.
This one requires deeper inhibition
from LGN to V1, right? Well, mediated by V1 interneurons, yeah. But it needs to be LGN driven, feed forward.
LGN projects to V1 inhibitory energy.
That's right. And there is, so as I'm going to show you, constraints from experiment are that there is very strong feedforward inhibition in LG in V1 in layer 4. So where are we now? Well, we're about to get into then, which we've talked about, what's the structure of the LGN input, and now we're going to start talking about how antiphase inhibition, or more generally, correlation-based circuitry, can explain orientation tuning. And to do that, I want to just start by saying what were the experimental constraints on the cortical connectivity that we started with. And the biggest one was the idea that there really is antiphase inhibition, or that excitation and inhibition are in a push-pull arrangement. So this shows from work of Judith Hirsch, this shows where she was intracellularly recording from a cortical cell, and she mapped out a region in which dark gives EPSPs and region in which light gives EPSPs, so the off region and the on region. And now this shows the effect of putting a dark square over the off region, you get a nice depolarization. When you put a light square over the off region, you get a nice hyperpolarization. And what she's shown very, very elegantly is that, so you could imagine this hyperpolarization could come from two sources. It could come because you're inhibiting off-center LGN input, so you're withdrawing excitation. or it could come because you're actually exciting some cortical inhibitory interneuron, and so you're creating inhibition. And she showed by injecting hyperpolarizing current, showing that she could reverse the sign of this, that when she, as she crossed through the inhibitory reversal potential, she showed very nicely that this is synaptic inhibition. That this, so there's a pull in regions where dark causes excitation, light causes inhibition, and vice versa. In regions where light causes excitation, dark causes inhibition. This does not prove that it's feed forward, but sort of a suggestive argument is that to a small flash like this, cortical cells don't spike much, or excitatory cells don't spike much. They might give a couple spikes, but they don't spike much. But there's no proof in this little thing that it's feed forward. The other is just the time, is that it doesn't take. I think when she's looked carefully, so one of the things she's seen is that there's this push-pull exists at every point in the receptive field. Every pixel shows a push-pull, shows a dark inhibition if it shows a light excitation and vice versa. And the time difference, the pull, is about 2 milliseconds later than the push. And that suggests that it's just one extra synapse. So the push being the LGN direct input and the pull being disynaptic through an interneuron because it arrives 2 milliseconds later. Mitya.
Yeah, okay.
Peter.
So, a couple slides ago, you had option 3 and option 4. Option 4 is for the P4 inhibition. Option 3 was whatever.
Uh-huh.
The alternative, the competing sort of models are that you have LGN synapses on dense excitatory input, namely. And then to get rid of, get coverage invariance, you go from excitatory to inhibitory to back to excitatory. Versus P4 inhibition means you can have direct inhibitory cells.
What do you mean excitatory to inhibitory? Are you talking about like ring models and bump?
I mean, cross orientation requires that. Why don't you go back to the
okay. Yeah, are you talking about bump models, ring models, or?
I'm talking about. Okay. Basically, not synthetic inhibition.
Mm-hmm.
Class 2.
Mm-hmm.
All those models. The idea is, let's say, one stage plus a cell here and here, and you want this one to inhibit this one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's got to go through from excitatory to inhibitory to excitatory.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas,
mm-hmm. Or it could be an inhibitory cell that prefers this orientation.
So what's the big difference between 2 and 3? Really? I mean, in one case, LGN cells go inhibitory cell, which goes.
Both of these could be feed-forward inhibition. Both of these can be feed-forward. The difference is, are you getting your inhibition? Does your inhibition just depend on contrast, basically, that it ignores phase, or does your inhibition come from the opposite phase to you? The nice thing about coming at the opposite phase to you, well, there's two nice things about it. One is it means it gets out of the way when you're seeing your preferred stimulus, whereas if you're getting it from all phases, it stays there. It also fights your response to preferred stimulus. And the other nice thing is that it agrees with the experimental observation that all simple cells show this push-pull arrangement, that they all get inhibition, which is opposite in polarity to the excitation that they get.
The cross-orientation inhibition would come with the opposite phase.
Well, these two might be the same. I mean, here I'm thinking specifically of getting inhibition from cells that prefer the opposite orientation to you. Here I'm just thinking of getting, it might be from cells that prefer the same orientation to you but respond to all orientations, but just you get it mixed up from all phases. Cross-orientation inhibition is you're getting inhibition from a cell that prefers the opposite orientation to what you prefer. Antiphase inhibition is you're getting inhibition from a cell that prefers the same orientation as you, but it prefers dark where you prefer light, and it prefers light where you prefer dark. Or you're getting inhibition from an inhibitory cell that looks like that. So this push-pull, Judith sees it. I mean, she emphasizes every layer 4 simple cell has this push-pull. They have it everywhere in their receptive field. And so this is really the David Furster and earlier from extracellular recordings, Palmer and Davis, had all seen similar things. And this was really the experimental finding we were starting from in building this model. Another intracortical constraint is that excitation and inhibition have very similar orientation tuning. When you record intracellularly from layer 4 simple cells, This is from Anderson, Carandini, and Furster. Now, it was published in 2000. This is the inhibitory conductance versus stimulus orientation. This is the excitatory conductance versus stimulus orientation. They look at both the mean and the modulation. But basically, you see that the inhibition and the excitation have very similar tuning, except there's some mean excitation which is untuned. But there certainly isn't the case that inhibition has broader tuning than excitation, or that, you know, I mean, one way you could imagine building a simple cell is you get lots of excitation at your preferred orientation, but you get lots of inhibition at your non-preferred orientation. And that definitely isn't what they see. Your inhibition and your excitation have basically the same orientation tuning, and there's not much sign of a whole lot of cross-orientation inhibition. I mean, you have to get a little bit of inhibition at the null, because you get a little bit of excitation at the null, and you've got to cancel that. But there's no sign that you're sort of getting some big, strong, dominant inhibition from cells that are firing very strongly to the null and that prefer the null. And finally, there's lots of evidence that V1 layer 4 cells receive very strong and very fast feed-forward inhibition. Here, this is just an experiment that many people have done, but I'm showing you Furster and Jagadish doing it, where they shock the LGN. And so that means they're just non-specifically activating a whole bunch of LGN inputs. So what does that mean? If you think about your simple cell, it means that it's all of its feed-forward LGN excitation is getting activated, but also all of the feed-forward LGN excitation to whatever cells inhibit it are getting activated. And so you're basically, you're non-specifically activating all of your feed-forward excitation and all of your feed-forward inhibition at the same time. And what happens is first they see a little EPSP, which they attribute to the direct LGN input. Then they see a second EPSP, which they attribute to backfiring layer 6 cells that have axons up to layer 4 cells. But then before the cortical cell ever reaches spike threshold, you then get this massive IPSP. And you always see this when you shock LGN, or shock cortex for that matter, you get these massive IPSPs. Cortical cells don't spike in response to that shock. They never get to spike threshold because the feed-forward inhibition, and we think it's feed-forward both because of the timing and because the excitatory cells don't spike in response to the stimulus. But the inhibitory cells presumably do spike in response to the stimulus, and they're giving you this massive inhibition. So you very strong inhibition. If you activate all your feed-forward excitation and your feed-forward inhibition at the same time, the feed-forward inhibition wins. It wins by a long shot, and you don't get activated. There's also a lot of very nice studies in barrel cortex from Harvey Swadlow and Dan Simons suggesting the very same thing, that there's very strong feed-forward inhibition in layer 4.
Sometimes when I do this experiment, 15% of the time when I do this experiment, it should be spiked, right?
They don't get inhibitory neurons 15% of the time in patches. Inhibitory neurons are a lot small, hard to get. I mean, Judith's, yeah, she has, I mean, from many years of doing intracellular recording, I don't know how many excitatory cells she has, but she has about 10 inhibitory cells. Yeah, but where does the IPSP come from? It must come from cells that provide feed-forward inhibition to the cell. Right, but the point is the excitatory cells don't seem to spike to the stimulus. So you're activating all of your LGN inputs, and you're apparently activating all of the inhibitory cells. So you're activating all the inhibitory cells that make feed-forward connections to you, and you're activating all the LGN cells that make excitatory connections to you. Question is, who wins? The inhibition wins by a long shot. So the inhibition's really strong. It's strong enough to beat down your direct LGN input.
How clear is this evidence that the excitatory cannot drive into the excitatory cells?
No, probably there are some excitatory cells that spike, but I mean typically you just don't see spikes in response to this. It's not a watertight argument, because probably there's some excitatory cells that spike.
And in his previous intracellular recordings, I had the impression that excitation and inhibition are about equal in size.
No, the thing, you can't judge the strength from the degree of voltage change, because the strength is really the conductance change, but there's very little driving force on the inhibition, because you're very near the inhibitory reversal potential. There's a lot of driving force on the excitation. So as you move toward threshold, this effect will get bigger and this will get smaller. And what really counts is how they add up at threshold. So in terms of, what Judith has done is she studied the case where she moves the stimulus to be part, a little bit in the wrong subfield. And that typically leads to an inhibition. So. Okay, so all of this was a very long way to motivate the following very simple model of antiphase inhibition. So the idea is here I have two excitatory cells of opposite absolute spatial phase. So this is meant, these colors are meant to indicate absolute phase rather than relative phase. Two excitatory cells of opposite absolute spatial phase and two inhibitory cells of the same two opposite absolute phases. They're getting LGN inputs in a Hubel-Wiesel arrangement, and they're getting inhibited by a set of inhibitory cells whose collective receptive field is basically the antiphase opposite of the cell. And this inhibition is dominant, meaning that this pathway is stronger than this direct feed-forward pathway. And this, the basic claim is this antiphase inhibition solves the problem of contrast invariant tuning. And you should begin to get the idea of why. If we stimulate at the preferred orientation, then first this phase is being stimulated, and this phase is not, so all the inhibition is going off to cells that aren't receiving any excitation anyways. Then a little bit later, this phase is being activated, and this phase is not, and again, the inhibition goes off to the cells that aren't receiving any excitation. So everything works fine. This is activated, then this, then this, then this. But if I show the null orientation, I'm providing phase nonspecific input, so I'm activating both of these phases equally. And since this inhibition is stronger than this excitation, the cell doesn't respond. And now, if I think about starting at the preferred orientation and the preferred phase of this cell, so this cell is up at the peak of its firing curve, and this cell is down at the trough of its firing curve, and now I tilt my stimulus, so gradually this one is coming down from its peak toward its mean, this one is coming up from its trough toward its mean. At some orientation, the weaker input to this phase times the stronger connection will cancel the stronger input, and that's basically the orientation where you stop responding. And then the hand-waving explanation of contrast invariance is that you stay invariant because as you increase the contrast, you increase the drive here, but you increase the drive here. They keep up with each other, and that cutoff orientation stays roughly invariant. Mitya?
So wouldn't then there be a prediction that there's
very slow cell? Yes, it is a prediction, definitely. And yeah, I'll get to that in a couple slides, but.
But that's different from the
right. Or more generally, it predicts that the key thing is that these inhibitory neurons have to respond even to a null-oriented stimulus, right? So they could have contrast dependent, it could be contrast varying or contrast invarying, but the tuning curve at low contrast would look like this, and at high contrast would look like this. The tuning curve would look like the LGN input. Or it could be untuned. That would work. But what we're assuming is that it's tuned, but sitting on a plateau. But the main, the biggest prediction is that right there in the local column, there should be these inhibitory cells that respond to all orientations, even though they may show some tuning. And so then Judith has now come up with these complex cells, which are untuned for orientation. Well, that's not exactly what we were thinking of. We were thinking of the antiphase inhibition providing the inhibition at the null. But she is finding in layer 4 cells that respond to all orientations, including the null orientation of the local column. So just to show you how this goes, so at the preferred orientation, so this is the red is showing you the excitatory current to a cell, and the blue is showing you the inhibitory current to a cell. And this is showing you the cell's voltage. And so at the preferred orientation, excitation and inhibition modulate out of phase with one another. And so when the excitation is high and the inhibition is low, you get lots of spikes. At the null orientation, there's basically no modulation. And the inhibition dominates in the mean. In this particular case, it doesn't dominate by much. But the inhibition dominates in the mean, and you don't get much of a response. So one take-home lesson from this is that if the feed-forward inhibition dominates the feed-forward excitation, which we believe it does, then if you want to get a cell to respond, you have to give it a stimulus that evokes the feed, that doesn't evoke feed-forward excitation and feed-forward inhibition at the same time. You've got to either not evoke feed-forward inhibition somehow, or you've got to separate them in time. So if you can give a stimulus that separates the excitation and the inhibition in time, that modulates, temporally modulates the input, you respond to that. But if you give an input that doesn't temporally modulate the input, that activates the excitation and the inhibition together, you don't respond. And another way to look at what's happening, and now, Fred, I'll get to your question. Another way to look at what's happening is, with the LGN input, we started out with this tuning. Well, the inhibition is dominant, and it's turning, it takes the phase non-specific part of the input and turns it into a net inhibition. It takes the phase specific part and, in a sense, multiplies the F1 because it's adding to the modulation. And so what you see then is at the high contrast, you get the highest input, but you also get the highest inhibition at the off orientations. And you end up getting a region, you know, anywhere sort of from here to here, where you could draw a line and get roughly contrast invariant tuning. And so now the question is, well, doesn't this mean I've got to put the threshold at just the right place and I have to fine-tune my model in order to make this work? The empirical fact is no. I can just tell you, when we build the big model, and we never adjusted the threshold. Why is it not very sensitive? Well, basically, probably because the measures people use, half-width at half-height, are just not that sensitive to where threshold is, because these slopes are pretty steep. So I could have threshold down here, and I could have threshold up here, and I probably wouldn't see very much difference. I think that's the main reason. Another thing is that while we didn't adjust threshold, we always, as we increase inhibition, when we increased inhibition, we didn't change the other parameters. But we initially adjusted our parameters to make the simple cells spike at about half a hertz spontaneously, because we know that they have a little bit of spontaneous activity. Well, that's, in a sense, adjusting threshold, because it means the threshold isn't so far away that you don't have any spontaneous activity. And that seemed to be all we needed to do. If we just put threshold, or, you know, had our parameters such that you were occasionally spiking half a hertz, then we get contrast invariant orientation tuning. And the stronger the inhibition, you know, the further down this sinks, and so the narrower the orientation tuning. But you can, you know, we went over this wide range of inhibition without adjusting threshold at all, and the orientation tuning stays contrast invariant. It remains a little bit non-intuitive to me that it's so robust, but it is. Yeah, I don't think there's any overall systematic trend, at least in the simulations. Yeah. Let me just one or two slides, and it'll be a natural breakpoint. So we generalize this for, well, maybe four or five slides. We generalize this idea to correlation-based connectivity. So the idea, which is motivated by thinking about Hebbian synaptic plasticity, is that excitatory cells should connect to the cells that they're well correlated with, because that's what you would expect to arise from a Hebbian rule, and that inhibitory cells should connect to cells that they're well anti-correlated with. Because, again, you might expect that to happen from a Hebbian rule. If this cell inhibits that cell, then when this cell is activated, that cell tends to not be activated at the same time, so they don't want to learn the same stimulus. They want to learn anti-correlated stimuli that don't appear at the same time. So we set up a whole model I'll tell you. So those. Yes. No, because they're uncorrelated rather than anti-correlated. If you think about it, they share some inputs. So we define correlation by the overlap of the LGN receptive fields, the LGN inputs of the cells. And if you're the opposite orientation, you share some inputs, and you don't share some inputs. So you're uncorrelated rather than anti-correlated. You're anti-correlated if you're the opposite phase, because then everywhere you have on, you have off. Everywhere you have off, you have on. So what we do is we establish connectivity statistically by just saying, if you're an excitatory cell, so we look at every pair of cells, and for every pair we say, what's the correlation in their receptive fields? And then if you're an excitatory cell, your probability of making a connection is some monotonically increasing function of the correlation between the two receptive fields. If you're an inhibitory cell, the probability of making a connection is some monotonically increasing function of the anti-correlation. of the receptive fields. And so we just establish connectivity probabilistically. Oh, and also, you can put in all the connections. So excitatory cells tend to connect to cells they're correlated with, either excitatory or inhibitory. And inhibitory cells tend to connect to cells they're anti-correlated with, either excitatory or inhibitory, with one proviso. You actually need to keep these connections pretty weak, because if these inhibitory to inhibitory connections get too strong, what happens is you get a winner-take-all happening between the two phases. So if this phase is getting a little bit more input, it just suppresses that phase, and you can't get the weaker input times the stronger weight winning and suppressing the response. So you, these weights have to be weak enough that you don't get into a winner-take-all situation between opposite phases. And so in the full model, we have 2,000 cells, 1,600 excitatory, 400 inhibitory. We took a little piece of a real orientation map, and so this is 40 by 40 pixels, which makes 1,600 excitatory cells, and every 4 pixels there's an inhibitory cell. We just assign the orientation according to the orientation in this map. We assign the spatial phase randomly. Then we connect things up in this correlation-based way. And so, for example, this cell at X gets excitatory input from all the white cells and gets inhibitory input from all the black locations. And, you know, they have this, if the excitatory and the inhibitory input it receives have the same distribution in orientation, because obviously these connection functions don't differ by orientation, they only differ in phase. Inhibition wants to see the opposite phase, and excitation wants to see the same phase. We use conductance-based integrate and fire cells, and so far, I'll tell you later about NMDA, but so far we're just using AMPA for excitation and GABA-A for inhibition. The strength of the connection. Well, so this is we connected with a certain probability, and then what we did was we had a way of trying to remember. What we did was we did multiple picks from the same probability distribution, and so the higher probability, you're more likely to get 3 weights instead of 1 or something like that, and so then this is just showing after we've done the picking the actual results for one cell with the strength of the weights shown in the size. And indeed, excitatory cells show nice contrast and variant orientation tuning. Here's different contrast. But then the key prediction is that the inhibitory cells should respond like the LGN input, because somebody's got to, that you're getting this driving LGN input. Somebody's got to respond to that and turn everybody else off. We're saying it's the local antiphase cells, so they should have orientation tuning that looks like this, which may or may not be contrast invariant, but at any rate, you're responding to all orientations in a way that grows with contrast. So that's the key prediction. There should be such inhibitory cells, and so it's nice that Judith has now found untuned cells in layer 4, which is sort of, at least it's, you know, it's along the lines of what we were thinking, but it's not the same thing.
What was the
ABV? Oh, basically LGN cells are pretty close to saturated at 50%, so there isn't much difference between anything above 50. There's a little, but it's not much. I think if you look at response versus log contrast, it's fairly linear. And so it's, you know, there isn't that much difference between 50 and 80 on a log scale. So in conclusion, the LGN input alone creates a confusion between a stimulus feature orientation and stimulus magnitude contrast. When I see a certain rate of input, I might be seeing my preferred orientation at low contrast, or I might be seeing a non-preferred orientation at high contrast, and I can't tell the difference. Antiphase inhibition disambiguates the two. If my antiphase partner is getting inhibition at the same time as I am, I'm not seeing my preferred stimulus and I don't want to respond, even if I'm getting lots of input. If my antiphase partner is not getting input when I am seeing my preferred stimulus, and so I can respond even if it's low magnitude input. So it gives you magnitude invariant form recognition. You recognize your preferred pattern even at low magnitude and don't respond to a non-preferred pattern even at high magnitude, or contrast invariant orientation tuning. Complete circuit leads to contrast invariant orientation tuning, and the model predicts the presence of inhibitory cells that should respond to the null orientation in a contrast-dependent manner. So that's a good stopping point. Oh, thought, okay, that's a good stopping point. Yeah, so I didn't tell you what, I should have mentioned what this feedback excitation does, is it basically amplifies responses to an effective stimulus. So if you get a stimulus in which the feed-forward excitation wins, then you can amplify your response to it. But the question of what you respond to is still determined by the feed-forward inputs, because if you're not spiking, then this feedback doesn't do anything. So basically, the excitation, the feedback excitation onto excitatory cells, all it does is amplify your tuning curve, but it doesn't change the shape of your tuning curve. It lets you have weak enough LGN inputs that, so there isn't much conductance change to a null-oriented stimulus, certainly not much inhibition, but maybe 20% conductance change. And it lets you get within that magic 20% number, that you can have weak LGN inputs and weak feed-forward inhibition and still get good, robust responses, because you can amplify up the responses once you get...
All right, so does feedback make it more robust?
No, it just gives you bigger responses. And the feedback onto the inhibitory cells does nothing at all, because all it does is when this phase is responding, it drives inhibition onto the other phase, but the two phases are never responding at the same time anyways. So all it does is drive inhibition onto cells that aren't responding. So you can have these here or cut them out, and it makes no difference. That's what I was saying. This has to be weak, because if it... Yeah. Actually, the simulation we ran, we didn't have these connections at all. If they're weak, you know, weak enough, they might as well not be there. If they get too strong, then you get this winner-take-all effect.
So what's the big difference is that the feed-forward inhibition from the other feedback model, like Summers?
Where I'm going to go in a minute, we'll amplify the differences between the two kinds of models. But so the main, before we came up with this model, the main model of contrast invariant orientation tuning were the so-called feedback models of Chaim Sampolinsky and of David Summers. And the basic idea there is that you have a connectivity pattern, which is a function of orientation, that cells tend to excite other cells of similar preferred orientation and tend to inhibit other cells of more different or preferred orientations. So you have a Mexican hat connectivity pattern in orientation space. And this is happening in a highly nonlinear, highly recurrent, highly nonlinear regime where you're really feedback driven. And the idea is that sets a length scale in cortex. Because in cortex, then, you're going to want to have activity bubbles of a certain size in orientation space that are surrounded by rings of inhibition. And that size is not a function of the stimulus you're presenting. It's just a function of the cortical connectivity. The cortical connectivity determines the size of an activity bubble. But the size of an activity bubble is the same as the width of an orientation tuning curve. Because if an activity bubble stretches out 15 degrees from its center, 15 degrees in orientation from its center, it means cells 15 degrees away from there can respond. It means your orientation tuning curve goes to zero 15 degrees away from your preferred orientation. So by setting a length scale in orientation space, they set a length scale for an orientation tuning curve. And so basically, because that's a cortical length scale, it doesn't depend on the stimulus, then it gives you contrast invariant tuning because you don't care about the stimulus. You show a low contrast stimulus, you show a high contrast stimulus, you get activity bubbles of the same size. They get bigger with the high contrast stimulus, but the size is a cortical property. So the main idea then is you get contrast invariant orientation tuning because you get everything invariant. You get stimulus invariant orientation tuning. So the big question then is orientation tuning really stimulus independent? Well, it's not. For example, a long bar gives you narrower tuning than a short bar. And a high frequency grating gives you narrower tuning than a low frequency grating. I'll show you that in a minute. And in general, at least in CAT, the orientation tuning behaves as you would predict if it's determined by the feed forward that you look at the tuning of your LGN input, and that is monotonically related to the tuning of your cortical cell spiking. That's how things seem to actually behave. And that's how this model behaves, because in this model the tuning is determined by the F1 of the LGN input. Whereas in the feedback models, they really postulate that that tuning is a cortical property independent of other parameters, and that's how they get contrast invariance, because contrast is just one stimulus parameter. I'll tell you a little bit more about that when we come back. So let me tell you just a couple more things about orientation tuning in this model, and then go on to other features of the model. So a very seminal experiment, I think, was David Furster's cooling experiment, where trying to settle the whole feed-forward versus feedback question once and for all, David wanted to know, of course he didn't, but he tried to. He asked, what is the orientation tuning of the thalamic input if you take away the cortex, and how does it compare to the tuning of the tuning that you get when the cortex is intact? And so what he did was first, so here he's showing drifting gratings, he's recording intracellularly, and these are the voltage traces you get to different orientations of drifting grating. And you see that to some orientations you get a very big modulation, and here's 180 degrees away again, a big modulation, and to other orientations there's basically no voltage modulation. And then what he did, so you can plot the size of this, so he didn't measure the DC, but he measured the F1, the size of this modulation, and he plots here 38 degrees, normal, a drifting grating, full field drifting grating. Running all the time. Here's the tuning versus orientation of the F1 of the voltage response in the white squares. And then what he did was he cooled the cortex, and cooling the cortex prevents somata, prevents cell bodies from initiating action potentials. But the so he's presumably in layer 4. He didn't actually prove that he was in layer 4, but he's recording from these small simple cells, which he knows from lots of previous experience get are in layer 4, are getting strong LGN input. So these are layer 4 simple cells. In fact, when he recorded, when he was outside of layer 4, when he wasn't in a small simple cell, then when he cooled, he saw that he just got no response to the stimulus.
And why not the DC also?
Because he couldn't measure these voltage responses in the cooled case were too small. He couldn't reliably measure the DC, basically. So he could. But he didn't tell us. But he couldn't compare the two cases. Yes, they will. But what's going to happen? Well, yes. Well, so let me just go through the experiment, and then we'll get back to that point. But yes, they will. Axons can still transmit, though, and they can. Synaptic vesicles can still release. Everything is slower and weaker. Yes. Should lose all the inhibition. And what he sees, and then when he looks at the voltage modulation, is it basically has exactly the same tuning. It's a lot smaller. This is 1/10 the size. But if you look at the tuning on the, you know, here's the amplitude at 9 degrees, here's the amplitude at 38 degrees, they completely overlie each other. So again, this is the tuning of the F1, not the DC. Well, the key point is that with antiphase inhibition, the inhibition adds to the F1, subtracts the DC, right? And the F1, at least in our model, the F1 induced by the inhibition is the same as the F1 induced by the excitation. They have the same orientation tuning.
What do you mean exactly by F1?
The amplitude of this modulation. So there's some mean level of voltage, and then there's an amplitude of modulation about the mean. And so how big a voltage modulation are you getting? So the key point is that the F1, at least in this antiphase model, should have the tuning that's just driven by the LGN inputs. Because the LGN inputs drive some F1, and they drive inhibition that has the same F1, but opposite phase. And also the inhibition then removes the DC, or turns the DC into a net inhibition. But the tuning of the F1 of the voltage is determined by the LGN inputs. Everything else in the circuit just follows that tuning. Similarly, the cortical excitation just follows that tuning. It amplifies where you're getting voltage responses. So indeed, that's how the model behaves. What I'm showing you here in the model, of course, it's easy to turn off the cortex. And so here's the tuning of the F1. When we only have thalamocortical inputs, we remove the cortex. With the full circuit, it's in green. And the red is the blue just scaled up. And you can see that they basically have identical tuning. And what's important here, well, actually, let me make a couple of caveats. So did David really shut off the cortex? Well, he recorded extracellularly, and what he reported was that his protocol shut off everything except In layer 6, there was still a little bit of spiking. He called it about 15% of normal response in layer 6. So if you want to, you could worry about the fact that there's a little bit of spiking in layer 6 that might be contributing to this.
So what is this making?
One at a time. What was the contrast? I think they're high contrast gratings.
What exactly is it?
Voltage, intracellular voltage in response. So he's passed on to a cell. He's measuring the intracellular voltage responses to a sinusoidal drifting grating.
So that's assumed to be EPSPs coming from
thalamus? Well, in the cooled case, it's assumed to be EPSPs coming from thalamus. In the warm case, it's a mix of everything. Yeah. But as I say, there might be a little bit of input coming from layer 6 because there's a few spikes left there. And also Mrigaka pointed out, he's using full field gratings, so he's activating cells that are outside the cooled area, so you may have these very long distance connections coming in, although layer 4 doesn't really get long distance connections. So that seems unlikely to me, assuming the simple cells are in layer 4. And Judith Hirsch, I just heard talk yesterday, she reports that she's able to actually, she fills her cells because she's recording intracellularly, so she knows where they are. And she's found simple cells throughout layer 4, and then only one simple cell ever outside of layer 4 of these sort of at least two subregion or more simple cells. So, and layer 4 cells don't get these widespread long range in connections. But there are things that go a couple of millimeters in layer 4, but they don't go 8 millimeters the way they do in layer 2, 3, and layer 5. And he cooled the whole surface of cortex. So, and in fact, he cooled it bilaterally, so he got rid of callosal input as well. And he was cooling area 18 at the same time, so he got rid of area 18 input. So I tend to believe it. And then also, in fact, he repeated the experiment a different way, getting rid of cortex a different way with shock and activation, and got basically the same result, that the orientation tuning didn't change when the cortex was inactivated. So, but if you're not inclined to believe in that the tuning is determined by the feed-forward input, then you're inclined to think about all these problems with David's experiments and not believe them, even though, to my mind, he did the same thing two different ways and got the same result both ways. You have to really imagine a big conspiracy of artifacts to get the same artifacts from two completely different methods. And both cases find the orientation tuning doesn't change. But maybe.
But you found the thing that scaled down the factor of
10. Yeah. Well, the factor of 10 is partly due to the cooling causes less release than normal. So he tried to correct for that by looking at the response to LGN shocks in the cooled versus the warm condition. And when he corrected for that, he guessed that really the difference here is more like a factor of 2 or 3, factor of 3 maybe.
This doesn't show that there's no contrast in cortex is required for contrast.
Right, and this doesn't say anything, right. And in fact, as I was pointing, I mean, the main, at least in the model, we get nice contrast invariance with the F1 following the tuning of the input. You know, and the main problem for the contrast invariance is not the F1, but the DC. But now another thing to realize is that, as I was saying before, the tuning of the F1 of the LGN input, I was pointing to my monitor, that doesn't help much, the tuning of the F1 of the LGN input is not a fixed property. It depends on what stimulus you're showing. Different stimuli have different tuning. And so the fact that he gets a match between the tuning for the particular stimulus he happened to use in the cooled case and in the warm case suggests that the cortex is following the thalamus. Because if the cortex, I mean, the alternative is to say the cortex has its own length scale of tuning, and it just happened to match the particular stimulus that David happened to use. That seems highly unlikely. Because, so the main point is that different stimuli have different tuning. So for example, if you consider stimuli of different spatial frequencies, at low spatial frequency, you have to change the orientation by a lot before you change the modulation very much. So you have very broad tuning of the F1. It's low amplitude, but it's broad tuning. As you go to higher spatial frequencies, just a little bit of tilt will kill the modulation. And so you get much narrower tuning. So you get the tuning monotonically narrows of the LGN input, or the F1 of the LGN input, the tuning monotonically narrows as you go from low to high spatial frequency. And so That's what's shown here. The thalamocortical F1, here's high spatial frequency, or low spatial frequency, higher, higher, and higher. The tuning of the F1 of the thalamocortical input gets monotonically narrower. So, the x-axis is the thalamocortical, this is the orientation, and this is the F1 of the thalamocortical input. And so your orientation tuning of your F1 of your input is getting monotonically narrower as you increase spatial frequency. And in our model, the full circuit just follows right along. Whatever your thalamocortical tuning is, the full circuit tuning is just the same. So the difference between, here's the full circuit tuning, here's the thalamocortical circuit, here's the difference between them for the different spatial frequencies, and there's basically no systematic difference between them. The cortex is following the thalamus. So if you believe the cortex has a built-in length scale, then there has to be this incredible coincidence, which is that David just happened to pick the right stimulus to match the cortical length scale. It seems to me the much more robust or generic explanation is that the cortex is following the thalamus, and that's the only way David could have seen them to match, because thalamic tuning depends on what stimulus you use. And if they match, then the cortex must follow whatever you're giving from the thalamus. Mary? So, for example, in the feedback models where there's a certain size in orientation space of an activity bubble, that creates a creates a tuning width for a cortical cell, which is a cortical property. Well, in the feedback models, the connectivity was defined in orientation space, so it really didn't matter. You were excited by nearby orientations, inhibited by further away orientations, no matter where you were. Now, what you're thinking of is something more like the McLaughlin and Shapley model, where connectivity is a function of distance across cortex rather than distance in orientation. And so if you're near a pinwheel, you're sampling many different orientations, and if you're in a linear zone, you're sampling far fewer orientations. That model doesn't have a cortical length scale in it. I mean, it has a width of connectivity, but it doesn't have a cortically induced orientation tuning width. And in fact, that model is using phase nonspecific feedforward inhibition. It's not a feedback model. The main action in the McLaughlin and Shelley and Shapley model is that the feedforward inhibition is competing with the feedforward excitation, but the feedforward inhibition is phase nonspecific. You're getting inhibition from cells of all phases, because you get from everybody within a distance. They assume it's promiscuous, non-selective, only depends on distance. And the feedforward inhibition, as we were saying, the phase nonspecific inhibition can also help give you contrast, but they actually don't get contrast invariant orientation tuning. That's another important point. In the linear zones, so if they set they have phase nonspecific inhibition. If they made it stronger, they could have gotten contrast invariant orientation tuning. But they have it weak, so that in the linear zones, cortical cells respond to all orientations, although they have a peak at the preferred, but they respond to all orientations. And so you have contrast non-invariant orientation tuning in the linear zones. In the pinwheels, you're adding cross-orientation inhibition to this phase nonspecific inhibition, and there you get contrast invariant tuning. So they actually predict contrast non-invariant tuning away from pinwheels. They don't have a cortical length scale. So in their model, you should also see the tuning depend on the stimulus. That higher spatial frequencies should have narrower tuning than lower spatial frequencies, because their model is basically a feedforward model.
I think even with the, when you say feedback model, there's a degree.
Sure.
It's kind of like a continuum rather than
Certainly. In reality, I mean, feedback is certainly doing a lot of interesting things, but what I mean is a model for the mechanism that gives you contrast invariant orientation tuning. And in the feedback sort of models, you need to be in the strongly nonlinear regime or you won't be contrast invariant, because the way they get contrast invariance is by making their activity bubble size not depend on the stimulus. That's where the contrast invariance comes from. Now, if you're getting contrast invariance some different way, then you could also have feedback and maybe in a less strong regime. And maybe it wouldn't mess up contrast invariance.
That's true, but even in the extreme nonlinear regime, there is still, the tuning width isn't fixed. There's still some slop.
Not much. Not much. It's very hard to move it.
Well, I mean, it depends on how you saturate it.
Okay, it's maybe you've studied them. I haven't studied them that carefully, but it's my impression that it's very hard to design a stimulus that will budge. It will budge you very much from sort of just what you expect from the excitation length and the inhibition length. So, at any rate, David's experiment suggests that where whatever stimulus you're showing, the cortical F1 tuning is following this lemma cortical tuning, which is what this model does. And that also predicts, of course, that the half width at half height of your orientation tuning, your bandwidth of orientation tuning, should monotonically go down with spatial frequency. Yeah. Yes. Zero is orientation. This is orientation. Spatial frequency? No, it doesn't. Zero here always means the cell's preferred orientation, and it's the same at any. No. Because the cell has a preferred orientation. The cell has a preferred orientation that's defined by the Gabor function receptive field we gave it, and that's zero.
So this also shows that.
This is model. Yeah. Now, the experimental data is just that at one, for one particular stimulus that David happened to use, these two were matched. And what I'm showing you is that since that should depend on the stimulus, and therefore the cortex should follow. Actually, there's a lot of data that preferred orientation does not depend on spatial frequency. You can look at Naum Issa's recent paper on spatial frequency using imaging as well as electrodes, but there's previous work. Preferred orientation doesn't depend on spatial frequency, but orientation tuning bandwidth does. And it monotonically narrows, and here's some data. So this is what the model predicts, and indeed the data. Here's orientation tuning bandwidth decreasing with spatial frequency, decreasing with spatial frequency, decreasing with spatial frequency. And it almost has to, and now Missa showed the same thing more recently in imaging experiments. And it has to if the full circuit F1 follows the thalamocortical F1, and then the spike tuning is some thresholded version of the voltage F1 plus the DC, then you know you basically pretty much have to follow.
What's the unit?
I'm not sure what the unit is on this here. This is a tuning width of some kind. Tuning half width. This is spatial frequency on a log axis. I don't remember if this is a log axis or a linear axis. So, right. So a feed-forward model is consistent with this sort of data. Okay. So let's move on beyond orientation tuning. We designed the model. Basically, we started out thinking about orientation tuning and thinking about the fact that there's push-pull inhibition and trying to figure out what it would do, and found that it gave contrast invariant tuning, and it led to the story I just told you. But then we realized that the same principles could also explain another feature, which is temporal frequency tuning. And the issue here is that the cortex is much slower than the thalamus. So the cortex here's temporal frequency of a stimulus, and the cortex likes much lower temporal frequencies than the LGN. And in fact, this data from Saul and Humphrey probably understates the issue, understates the degree of shift, because the LGN, in most people's hands, LGN XLs tend to peak around 16 hertz. And so, whereas this looks very much like what most people see for cortical, for V1, drifting grading. And the temporal frequency of a drifting grading, of the preferred orientation, the preferred spatial frequency. How fast you drift it, exactly. The faster you drift it, The cortical cells basically just don't like fast stimuli. If you're stimulating with a hand lamp, you have a little bar and you're stimulating and you're listening to the cell, you know, you have to move very slowly. And if you move fast, if you're in layer 4, you can hear the thalamic afferents going whoosh, 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 whoosh. But the cortical cells don't respond. So fast stimuli that drive the LGN perfectly well don't drive the cortex. And as I say, really this gap is much bigger. So this is not just in V1, in general, across modalities, cortex won't follow fast stimuli that the thalamus follows perfectly well. Why?
troublesome is that to attach full field that we can record from front as well. Possible times to them which have frequency components up to 100 hertz.
Is that in area 17 or in area 18?
Area 17.
Yeah, I mean in 8. Looks exactly like what?
So you give a signal pulse, and you get some pulse response, and you give the sequence of the response, and it's just what you predict from the signal.
That's interesting. I mean, an area 18 will follow hot, faster speeds because it gets Y cell rather than X cell input. But.
I mean, so you flicker something to target first, and then you have a strong on it, but it's all in the. So that sort of completes the flicker fusion.
Oh, yeah, you can test the sequence is much higher.
In humans at 50 hertz, you can kind of see flicker.
Also, the cortex is nonlinear. I mean, the cortex is nonlinear to some extent in that, you know, the response to drifting sinusoidal gratings, you can get responses to faster components. Like if you give broadband stimuli, you can get faster components of response. So it isn't perfectly linear. No, that's for drifting gratings, that's very typical. Yeah. Huh. It's interesting.
So in psychophysics, you start to blur out.
That's the flicker fusion rate that they were just talking about, and I'm not sure what that is for a cat. Okay, so. There's experiments from Clay Reed and from some other people. Experiments from Clay Reed showing that if you mix a lot of frequencies together, then you will get high frequency components to your response. So it's not perfectly linear. At any rate, what I've shown you so far won't explain this. So the model simple cell I've shown you so far just follows. So this is now the model LGN cell we're really using, which is peaked around 16 hertz. And the model simple cell follows. Why does it follow? Well, because excitation and inhibition can stay separated, can keep out of each other's way, even up at 16 hertz. So here we're looking at the excitation and the inhibition current and then the voltage to a cell at 1 hertz, 4 hertz, and 16 hertz. And you see even at 16 hertz, the excitation and the inhibition are coming at opposite phases, staying out of each other's way. So what would keep you from responding at high temporal frequency? Well, the key point is we're assuming that in the mean, your input is inhibitory. Your average input is inhibition. And the only way you can respond is by modulating your input, because the excitation and the inhibition modulate at opposite phase with one another. And that modulation lets excitation escape from the inhibition, even though the inhibition is stronger on average. So what will prevent you from following is something that demodulates the input, something that reduces you back to your mean, something that low-pass filters your input. If you low-pass filter the input so you can't follow these fast modulations, then you get reduced to your mean input, and the inhibition wins, and you can't respond. So what would low-pass filter the input? Well, one thing is the time constant of the cell, but that's too small. That's not enough. I mean, the time constant of the cell is included here, and it's following at 16 hertz just fine. But another thing that can demodulate you is slow synapses, like GABA-B for inhibition or NMDA for excitation. Because then for every incoming thalamic spike, you're opening something that's an event that happens for a long time. And then now the next cycle comes, you're still responding to the last cycle. So you get smushed out. You get low-pass filtered. And so what we then suggest is that NMDA in the thalamocortical synapses if they're in thalamocortical synapses under excitatory cells, then they're going to low-pass filter your excitation, demodulate your excitation. If they're on excitatory synapses onto inhibitory cells, they're going to low-pass filter your inhibition and demodulate your inhibition. And there's some evidence that there's less NMDA in excitatory synapses under inhibitory cells than onto excitatory synapses under excitatory cells. So we're going to be concerned about, is it enough to just have the NMDA here, or does it have to be in both places? We also looked at the effect of NMDA in recurrent synapses, and to make a long story short, that won't do the job. The NMDA has to be in the feed-forward synapses to do the job. So,
can I have a question?
Yeah.
So you're running a network with no II connection.
That's right.
It pretty much rules out That means it can't really be in the valve specification.
Why not?
Because you have a hub sensibility. You need eye-to-eye connection to stay away from that. It sort of means that, and I could be wrong here, but I think it means you're in sort of the low gain domain. Living low, I mean,
I don't think so. I mean, the individual cells are basically what we, you know, the Troyer and Miller 97 paper.
Well, the connectivity. The question is, has the connectivity high enough to really give you high gain?
I see. I don't know.
Anyhow, for the classic balance excitation inhibition,
mm-hmm.
you know, in recent supplements, you definitely need eye-to-eye connectivity, or you can't get those.
Yeah, but don't forget that there's, I mean, here, this is a more complex model because you've got these two phases, you know. We have to look carefully and see if that model applies to this model. I mean, you know, this guy excites that, this guy inhibits that, which excites that, which inhibits that, which excites that. So, I mean, there are pathways by which inhibitory cells influence one another. Okay, I don't know. Okay. Is that a problem that we're not in the high coupling regime?
I mean, yeah, is that a problem? So cortex generally is high connectivity. Thus, you and I, high gain regime.
Well, what's the empirical correlate of being in the high gain regime? I mean, why empirically should we think that's where cortex lives?
Depends on the strength, right? But generally, cortex, if excitatory neuron spikes in the presence of sort of ongoing activity, it's likely to cause more than one spike, gain greater than one. In that machine, you really need eye-to-eye coupling or things.
Well, but who says gain? If you look at cortical cross correlations, they don't suggest a gain greater than one. I mean, the rate of following in a cross correlation is small. You know that. Yeah, I probably do.
You can sort of calculate from first principle. Ask how many people you have to get for two times neuron firing. It turns out to be pretty high. High enough so that, I mean, how much average current in a single spike would be?
Mm-hmm.
That's on the order of 10 to the nanometer.
Well, we should. It sounds like a topic for. Maybe you should give us a talk on this. And then we can try. I mean, I don't really understand if there, you know, empirically how we should evaluate that, but. Sounds like a topic for another talk.
Well, once you get into this wrong coupling regime, you need, I'm not sure if
I answered your question. Peter, that's in a mean field.
That's in a mean field.
This is that spatial dependence.
It's spatial dependence. So
you showed that you push back the Hund classification. It's spatial dependence. Okay. So, I mean, then it becomes a triple parameter.
Maybe this afternoon. Is there anything scheduled this afternoon?
In the colloquium at 4.
Huh.
Oops.
What's that?
I want to go to the
colloquium. Yeah, colloquium was very interesting.
All right, well. All right, so not this afternoon, but you should, maybe tomorrow or something, you should schedule a time to talk about this. Okay, so is there NMDA tension? Is there NMDA in thalamocortical synapses? Well, from Crer and Malenka in thalamocortical slices, measured the AMPA current by going down to minus 90, which blocked the NMDA receptor, and measured the NMDA current by putting in CNQX and going up to plus 40, so there was no voltage block of the NMDA. And this is what they found in thalamocortical synapses, so we just matched it. We matched what they found at the oldest ages they studied, because NMDA comes down with age, but the NMDA had come down quite a bit. So at the oldest age they studied and put that in, If we put it in all the thalamocortical synapses, both onto excitatory and onto inhibitory synapses, we get maybe too much of a cutoff. So already at 4 hertz, you can see this, you know, at 1 hertz, you've got nice modulation and nice response. At 4 hertz, things are starting to demodulate, excitation just barely creeping out over inhibition, get a few spikes. And at 16 hertz, the inhibition is completely dominant. Things are demodulated, and there's no response.
What's the proportion between alpha and beta?
We just matched this.
Well,
in terms of the charge transfer, it's about 90% NMDA.
90%?
Yep. In terms of charge transfer. But, you know, amplitude, NMDA is smaller, but it's much longer, so you get a lot of charge transfer. The inhibition is GABA-A right now. So GABA-B inhibition would do the same thing. Yeah, so we didn't include GABA-B here. That's right. No, they will counterbalance because when they cease modulate, it turns out, yeah, I see what you're saying, but it turns out we tested having NMDA to I alone, NMDA to inhibitory cells alone, NMDA to excitatory cells alone, or NMDA to both. And
the model requires expectations.
No, I understand what you're saying, or at the same speed. The funny thing is that Klaus, I understand what you're saying, but in fact, if the we have a parameter in the paper. We studied the percentage of NMDA to I versus the percentage of NMDA to E. And if anything, having NMDA to I was more effective than NMDA to E. And demodulating the inhibition alone was enough to cut off responses. Now, I see what you're saying, and I, at the moment, don't understand exactly why that's not a problem. But in fact, NMDA to I works perfectly well. So demodulating inhibition works even better than demodulating expectation. I guess basically the point is that you're, you know, it's important that since the inhibition is dominant in the mean, it's got to actually go down to let the excitation escape. And if you demodulate it, then since the inhibition is weaker, it just doesn't modulate up above the mean level of the inhibition. So demodulating the inhibition prevents these troughs, and that prevents your responses. So what this should remind you of, so what are we saying here? You're getting lots of LGN input at 16 hertz. You're driving the LGN perfectly well. The cortex is ignoring it. Why is it ignoring it? Because it's demodulated and inhibition is dominant in the mean. That's exactly the same explanation we gave for why you don't respond to the null orientation. At the null orientation, you're getting lots of LGN input, but it's demodulated and inhibition dominates in the mean. And so we're saying that the same principle that explains orientation tuning explains temporal frequency tuning, that the inhibition is dominant and you can only respond then to stimuli that cause the temporal modulation of the input. And so note that in order for this to work, it's not enough just to have NMDA synapses in any old model or GABA-B synapses in any old model. You've got the other key requirement is that the inhibition has to be dominant in the mean. So in the feedback models, when you're seeing a preferred stimulus, your mean input is excitatory. You're getting lots of excitation. So if you put NMDA synapses into a feedback model, it wouldn't cut you off. Sure, you could demodulate the input, but you're still getting net excitation. It has to be the case that your mean input is inhibitory in order for slow synapses to cut you off. So it's a key requirement that isn't met, as far as I understand, by the feedback models. And actually, it'd be interesting if it's met by your model, that if inhibition is dominant in the mean, when you're seeing a preferred stimulus. Yeah. So, and when we... So basically the story is, here's the LGN tuning, here's the cortical cell with only AMPA, here's NMDA onto both E and I, here's NMDA onto E alone. And NMDA onto E alone seems to be in just about the right place, which is nice because there's evidence that there isn't so much NMDA onto excitatory synapses onto I cells. So NMDA onto E alone seems to be enough, and so we can explain temporal frequency tuning. So how long should I aim to go? 1:45?
Yeah, 1:45 is fine.
Well, okay, I'm going to skip this part. I'll tell you a little bit about this part, but not much, because I want to make sure I get through these last two parts. Basically, there's a, so this is all published, you can look it up, it's in JNR Physiology, both papers. There's a class of effects which are so-called nonlinear response properties. And there's a model that some of you may know called the normalization model, which is aimed at explaining these nonlinear response properties. So this is the point in the talk where I tell you why this is not a good idea. So I sort of rag on the normalization model here. So as proposed originally by David Heeger and then Carandini, Heeger, and Motion have developed it a lot, the basic model is this. They assume that a simple cell is getting linear input, or that it, that its input results from some linear operator applied to the stimulus. So you start with linear input. Well, that already has contrast invariant orientation tuning. If you apply a linear operator to the scene and you change the contrast, you're just scaling the image essentially, and so you're going to scale the orientation tuning curve. So you're going to get contrast invariant orientation tuning. So they start with contrast invariant orientation tuning. But now there are all these nonlinear aspects of the response that they want to explain. So what are the nonlinear aspects of the response? Well, as you increase the contrast of a drifting sinusoidal grating, the phase of response advances. In a linear model, the phase would always stay the same. So you get a contrast-dependent phase advance. As you increase the contrast of the drifting grating, you get an increase in responsiveness to higher temporal frequencies. In a linear model, your temporal frequency tuning curve would be contrast invariant. The cortex tends to saturate, to reach saturation at lower contrast than the LGN. In a linear model, you would just follow the LGN saturation. There's the phenomenon of cross-orientation inhibition, which means if this is your preferred orientation, if you superimpose the null orientation at the same time, make a plaid, you don't respond to the null orientation alone. So in a linear response model, you wouldn't change your response by adding a stimulus that you don't respond to. But in fact, you decrease your response. So they call that a nonlinear response property, cross-orientation inhibition, that you decrease your response by superimposing the cross-orientation. And so the idea of the normalization model is, well, we start with this linear input. We've got to correct the linear input to explain all these nonlinearities. How do we correct the linear input? Well, we want to preserve our orientation tuning, which is the same at every contrast. So the output of our linear operator is some function of orientation and contrast. How about if we just divide by a function of contrast? That doesn't disturb our orientation tuning. So we can divide by a function of contrast, and that will allow us to explain some of these nonlinear properties without disturbing orientation tuning. And then these temporal properties, contrast-dependent phase advancing and changes in temporal frequency tuning, they explain by saying, well, how do you divide by a function of contrast? Well, they assume you're getting some pooled inhibition, normalizing inhibition that only depends on contrast and that is divisive in some way. And also this normalizing inhibition increases your conductance and increases your conductance so much that it shrinks your time constant so much that you get your phase advance and you get your change in temporal frequency tuning. Now, an obvious problem with that model is that in order to explain your low contrast temporal frequency tuning or your low contrast phase advance, well, basically they need to assume that at low contrast time constants are on the order of 100 milliseconds in order to have enough dynamic range in the time constant to change with contrast in order to explain these effects. But in fact, at rest, time constants are on the order of 20 milliseconds. So there just isn't enough dynamic range. You can't go below zero. There isn't enough dynamic range if you start with 20 milliseconds to explain these temporal effects. So that's one problem with the normalization model. But the other problem with the normalization model is a more basic problem, which is they assume you're starting with something linear, and then you have to add some circuitry to correct it and make things nonlinear. In fact, you're starting with a very nonlinear circuit. And the amazing thing is that the circuit can conspire to get out some properties that look linear, like contrast invariant orientation tuning. But even though the circuit may conspire to give you contrast invariant orientation tuning, there's lots of nonlinearities left, and so they may already explain all these nonlinear aspects of the response. You don't have to add some extra circuitry to explain the nonlinear aspects of response. So our view is that the circuit that achieves contrast invariant orientation tuning is already nonlinear, despite the fact that it shows some linear-like behavior. What are the nonlinearities? Well, they include synaptic depression, spike rate adaptation, conductance changes induced by stimuli, the fact that the input is nonlinear, there's a contrast-dependent mean which increases with contrast. In a linear model, when you change contrast, you don't change the mean luminance, so you don't change the mean response, and there's a spike threshold. And the first four of these all have increasing effect with increasing contrast. As you increase the contrast, you increase the driver of the input, you get more synaptic depression. You increase the driver of the output, you get more spike rate adaptation. You get more drive, so you get more conductance changes. You get a bigger mean. And so it stands to reason that you might see a lot of these contrast-dependent nonlinearities just based on the nonlinearities that are already in the model. So we wanted to address, can these explain nonlinear aspects of responses in the same circuit that simultaneously explains contrast invariant orientation tuning? And I'll make a long story short by saying the answer is yes. That, in fact, we can account for all these properties just in this, with the same circuit. We don't have to add anything to the circuit. And so there's no need for a normalization. There's no need for normalizing inhibition. You didn't start with linear input. Yes? Well, there's nothing in our model. Our model is really just modeling the classical receptive field. And there's no connectivity in our model beyond the classical receptive field. So we're not trying to model beyond the classical receptive field effects. But if I assume if you put in longer range connections, you could start to model beyond the classical receptive field effects. But at least for the within the class, so it's true, people have used normalization to try to explain some of the beyond the classical receptive field effects as well. But at least the within the classical receptive field effects that people explain with normalization, we don't need normalization to explain. Yeah, but it doesn't mean that they require normalization. Presumably, they require some longer range circuitry.
So, how do you get the cross-orientation?
Okay, so let's explain that. So, I mean, I was going to take you through how you get every one of these, but that would take me to 1215. So, I'm going to skip, and you can read the papers or you can ask me later. But how do you get the cross-orientation inhibition? Well, the main idea. Let's look at the LGN input to either the base is the preferred orientation stimulus, the mask is the null orientation stimulus. So the base plus the mask is the plaid made of putting the two stimuli together. So that's, just to make that clear, here's the base, that's the preferred orientation, the mask is the orthogonal organization. Put them together, that's base plus mask, you get a plaid. And the observation is that the response to a plaid is less than the response to the base alone, even though you don't respond to the mask. So if we look at the LGN input to a simple cell, Now, this is in the absence of synaptic depression. Then adding the mass doesn't change the F1 of the input much, but it increases the DC. So you're actually getting more input. You're driving the LGN cells harder. You have more contrast. But, of course, our inhibition turns the DC into a negative. And so an increased DC is increased inhibition. And so your peak input goes down. If you add synaptic depression, and this figure we left out of the paper in deference to David Heger and Matteo Carandini, because for some reason we in addressing all the other nonlinearities, the first paper, Kaiser et al., we included synaptic depression and we exhaustively studied the role of synaptic depression. Somehow in this model where we studied cross-orientation inhibition, which is the second paper, Lauritsen et al., we left synaptic depression out of the paper. I don't know why. And if we just don't, you know, I asked, does synaptic depression make any difference? I got told no, and then it just got left out. That's how it happened. And then Matteo and David came up with this idea, synaptic depression explains everything. It explains cross-orientation inhibition. So then we looked at it, and we got this result, but we left, then they said, oh, don't put that in because we want to publish that. And so we were nice to them, and we didn't put it in. But this is the result, that basically, here's the base alone, here's a 3 hertz mask, here's an 8 hertz mask. And so once you put in depression, the mask reduces the F1. That makes sense. The mask is driving the LGN cells harder, but with no F1. And that means the base F1 is hitting more depressed synapses, so it gets weaker. So the depression weakens the F1. The depression also eliminates the DC at 3 hertz, largely eliminates the DC at 3 hertz. But it can't eliminate the DC at 8 hertz. So when you have an 8 hertz mask, you get a significant DC. So the result is that depression alone is enough to explain some of the suppression to a 3 hertz mask, but not to a higher frequency mask. To a higher frequency mask, you need the inhibition to at least cancel the DC, if not slip the sign of the DC, and then you get nice inhibition. So their model is basically, it's like the normalization model. except instead of having a linear input plus normalization, they have a linear input plus synaptic depression. And so having a linear input means this DC isn't here. They don't have to worry about it. And so just getting this effect on the F1 is their explanation of the result. But what we would argue is that, look, you need inhibition to at least cancel the DC, which is what a linear model does, if not flip the sign of it, which is what a dominant inhibition model does, to fully explain the results at high temporal frequencies. But they just say, we have a linear model, we don't know where it came from, and then the depression is doing the job. Okay. So, how can this model circuit develop? So, and here I want to address two issues. One is the origins of the circuit I just talked about. How can the full functional circuit, both the geniculocortical, hubovesical connectivity, and the intracortical connections, how can that develop? But I also want to think about a more general question, which is, we know that you have this columnar invariance in cortex. We know that orientation is the same throughout a column. But not all properties are the same throughout a column. Now, for example, as I'm about to tell you, spatial phase seems to vary between cells recorded next to one another. Spatial phase doesn't seem to have a columnar representation. So why is it that some properties, like orientation, have a columnar representation and other ones are locally variable? Well, we're going to focus on a subset of that question and ask, why are some properties locally invariant in layer 4? If they have to be locally invariant in layer 4 to be a candidate for columnar invariance, and in fact, the strong vertical connectivity is likely to propagate properties that are invariant in layer 4 to other layers. On the other hand, properties that vary locally within layer 4 can't be invariant in a column, obviously. So we're going to focus on the question of which properties should show local invariance in layer 4. And so which properties are locally invariant? Well, orientation is, but nearby cells recorded on the same electrode definitely have different relative spatial phases. And although they didn't quite nail it, basically, this is from Freeman lab, their data strongly suggests that the nearby cells also have different absolute spatial phases. So, No. Relative spatial phases seem to form a continuum, at least in CAT. Absolute spatial phases, though, nobody really knows how diverse it is locally. It might be a continuum, but we don't know. This is Dario Ringach. So he was looking in monkey, and he claimed that most cells were either even or odd symmetric. And my interpretation of that is, I mean, basically what he also showed was that most of his cells were either one subregion or two subregion. Well, one subregion are automatically even symmetric. And two subregion, now I suppose you might say, well, one subregion could be very weak, you know, or it could be. So you could maybe have a continuous distribution for two subregions, but if they're, so I guess maybe the interesting thing is that the two subregion cells tended to have roughly equal strength, so they tended to be odd symmetric. So, but basically I think his result was most cells are either one subregion or two subregion, and when they're two subregion, they're relatively equal, so that they become odd symmetric. So, yeah, in CAT there seems to be a continuum. All right. So the basis of this modeling is going to be from previous work I published in 94 when I was asking the question, how do you just develop the Hubel-Wiesel pattern of feed-forward inputs, just of LGN inputs? In that paper, I didn't deal with any plasticity of intracortical connections. But the basic result of that paper was if you want to wire, you want a certain set of LGN cells to wire together. So you want a bunch of on-center cells here and a bunch of off-center cells here and here to all wire together onto the same postsynaptic cell, and you want that to happen by Hebbian rule, then they better fire together. And so statistically, it better be the case that when an on-center cell is active, it tends to be coactive with another cell that's next to it or other cells that are nearby of the same center type, but it tends to be more coactive with other cells of the opposite center type at further distances away. So that a cell here would tend to be more coactive with an on-center than with an off-center input at this distance, but would tend to be more coactive with an off-center than with an on-center input at these distances. And so we summarize that with this correlation function, which represents the difference between how well correlated are you with your own type and how well correlated are you with the opposite type as a function of retinotopic separation. And the key requirement is this should be a Mexican hat, that at small distances you should be better correlated with your own type. Excuse me, there's an assumption about the correlations in the LGN. At the time that. So the correlation in the LGN should be such that at small distances you're best correlated with your own center type, but at larger distances you're better correlated with the opposite center type than you are with your own center type. Good question. We don't know. It's sort of the main prediction of the model is that this should be the correlation structure. But I'll tell you a little bit more about that. And the result of the model is that if you have such a correlation structure, it can be circularly symmetric, but you'll get orientation selective simple cells. You'll break symmetry, which was presaged by the work of Linsker. So why, I can't tell you if it's true, but I can tell you why it's plausible. And why is it plausible? Well, everybody knows about this correlation structure, the retinal waves that exists very early in development, before the photoreceptors are functional. That basically goes away around the time the photoreceptors become functional and right before orientation selectivity develops. And for that reason and for a lot of other reasons, I don't think that structure is involved in forming orientation selectivity. So that's been replaced by some form of correlation structure which exists in the presence of functional photoreceptors. We don't know what correlation structure that is, but we do know what correlation structure you see in adults, which is induced by photoreceptors. And in adults, the correlation structure you see in the dark, in adult cat retinas from Mastronardi's work, is essentially, it's caused by spontaneous quantal events in photoreceptors. The numbers on this, I forget how they go, but I mean, an individual rhodopsin molecule will have a spontaneous transition as if it had captured a photon once in some ungodly length of time, like a billion years or something. But there's so many of them that, in fact, you get a reasonable amount of a spontaneous activity in the photoreceptors. And so what happens is if two on-center cells both share a photoreceptor, then whenever there's a spontaneous event in that photoreceptor, they'll both tend to spike in response to that, so their spikes will be correlated. So you have correlated firing in the dark. Similarly, if you have an on and an off cell whose centers both overlap the same photoreceptor, when that photoreceptor goes off, it suppresses the activity of the off-center cell, so these two cells will tend to be anticorrelated. However, so at small distances, same type is correlated, opposite types are anticorrelated. What isn't known is what happens at larger distances. But it sort of is plausible that at larger distances, when the center of one cell is in the surround of the other cell, that you should be better correlated with the opposite type, so that your center is the same type as the surround, then you should be with the same type. So it's just a plausibility argument based on receptive field structure and based on, who shares photoreceptors, that at small distances you should be best correlated with your own type, but at larger distances you should be better correlated with the opposite type. And what I did was just based on the length scales of this, so David Mastronardi worked out at what length this correlation fell to zero, but then he didn't go further and see if there was some new correlation that emerged on the other side of zero. But just taking that length scale at which correlations go to zero, so here's the length at which correlations go to zero, and twice that length I call L. And now the question is, suppose you have a Mexican hat which goes to zero at L. It turns out that in this model, the spatial frequency of the simple cell that develops, the preferred spatial frequency, should basically be the peak of the Fourier transform of this Cori correlation function. So what should be the peak of the Fourier transform of a Mexican hat function that goes to zero at distances L over 2? Well, basically, it should correspond to a period 2L. That's sort of the best guess you can make when you've only got this one length scale, L, is that this should be the peak of its Fourier transform. And so I took and